Imagine planning a family vacation, right?
Yeah.
But instead of anticipating relaxation, you're basically packing a defense strategy.
Right. Yeah. It's a completely different mindset.
Welcome to the deep dive, by the way. So glad to have you with us. But yeah, for families navigating autism, the very things that make travel exciting for a lot of
Well, the
people.
novelty.
Exactly. The novelty, the spontaneity, just taking a break from the daily routine. Those are exactly the things that can turn a trip into a total minefield.
Because you're dealing with so many unknown variables.
Yeah, you aren't just figuring out, how to fit sunscreen into a carry-on. You are trying to prepare an individual for a world that's suddenly going to become entirely unpredictable and just overwhelmingly loud.
It fundamentally changes the objective of the trip, really. I mean, the focus often shifts from, how do we have fun to
Yeah.
how do we mitigate the environmental threats.
Mitigate the threats. Wow. That sounds exhausting.
It is, because a standard vacation basically systematically dismantles all the structures an autistic child relies on to feel secure. But the goal shouldn't be to just barricade the doors and never leave the house, right? It's about strategic, proactive preparation. You change the environment rather than trying to force the child to endure it.
Which is exactly our mission for this deep dive. We are looking at this really comprehensive spring break safety and planning guide put together by AngelSense.
Right, the company that designs technology for neurodiverse individuals.
Exactly. And we're going to extract the mechanisms and the specific tactics that can actually transform a daunting family trip into an experience you genuinely want to do again.
That's the dream, right? A repeatable vacation.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because before we can fix the vacation, we have to establish why the standard travel model is so hostile to autistic neurology in the first place.
Well, if you look at the baseline of how an autistic individual navigates the world, routine isn't just a preference.
Right, it's not just liking things a certain way.
No, it is a regulatory tool. It's how their brain processes a world that is chronically overwhelming. I mean, every day they are managing a sensory input level that most of us would find exhausting.
Wow.
So routine is the framework that makes that input predictable. And when you travel, you obliterate that framework.
The analogy that always comes to mind for me is playing a video game. Imagine you're playing a game you've totally mastered.
Okay.
You know all the controls, you have the muscle memory for exactly how it works, and then without warning, someone remaps all the buttons.
Oh, that would be incredibly frustrating.
Right, you press the button to jump, and suddenly your character crouches. You try to move left, you just spin in a circle. You'd be intensely frustrated.
Yeah, you'd probably want to throw the controller.
Exactly. And that is what a standard vacation does to an autistic child's environment. We wake them up at like 4:00 a.m. to catch a flight, feed them fast food at the airport.
Put them in a totally different climate.
Yeah, surround them with the unfamiliar smells of a hotel room. It's a complete system remapping.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, it explains the severe physiological reactions you see. When you take away that regulatory routine and replace it with a confined space,
Like an airplane cabin.
right, or a packed train, where they have zero physical outlet, the tension just builds. Add in massive spring break crowds, the unpredictable noise of an airport terminal.
The lack of personal space.
Exactly. The brain is trying to process an onslaught of novel sensory data without any of those predictable frameworks to sort it. So the result isn't a child being, stubborn or fussy.
Right, it's literal sensory overload.
The brain essentially registers the environment as an active threat. It triggers a literal fight or flight response.
And when the brain registers a threat, the instinct is often to flee, which pivots us to something that's highly critical in these materials, the threat of wandering or elopement.
Yes, a huge concern.
Now, 50% of autistic children manage to escape from even supervised environments. That statistic is front and center here.
Right.
But honestly, 50% seems incredibly high.
It does sound high, yeah.
Like, if I'm watching my kid in an airport or a hotel lobby, how are they just vanishing?
Well, it seems high until you break down the mechanics of distraction and the removal of passive safety nets. Think about your home.
Okay.
You likely have deadbolts, maybe an enclosed backyard, and neighbors who recognize your child and would actually intervene if they saw them wandering down the street alone.
Right. The community kind of watches out.
Exactly. Your environment is doing a lot of the supervising for you. When you travel, those passive safety nets disappear entirely. You are in hotels with automatic sliding doors that just open for anyone.
And you're surrounded by complete strangers.
And the parents are handling logistics.
Ah, right. The cognitive load.
Picture the typical airport scenario. You are holding four passports, you're staring up at a departure board that just changed your gate, and you're fishing in your pocket for your phone to check a message from the rental car company.
Which takes your eyes off the child for what, maybe 15, 30 seconds?
Right. And in an unfamiliar, highly stimulating environment, a child experiencing sensory overload only needs 10 seconds to slip through an automatic door to try and escape the noise.
It's terrifying.
And if that happens, you are in a city where first responders have no idea who you are or what your child's specific needs might be.
So relying purely on parental vigilance is essentially a single point of failure.
Precisely.
The materials break down proactive safety tools to build redundancy, splitting them into high-tech and low-tech. On the high-tech side, there are GPS tracking devices specifically engineered for autism, like AngelSense.
Right. It's a very specialized tool.
But it's not just a standard tracker like you'd put on your keys. It features something called automatic pickup. Explain how that works, because the mechanism behind it seems really targeted at the psychology of a meltdown.
It is. It's entirely built around the psychology of panic. If an autistic child is overwhelmed, perhaps they are non-speaking, or maybe they are highly verbal, but extreme stress has just shut down their executive function.
They aren't going to answer a phone.
Exactly. They are not going to recognize a ringtone, fish a phone out of their pocket, swipe the screen, and hold a coherent conversation.
Makes sense.
The automatic pickup feature bypasses that entirely. The parent can activate a two-way audio channel from their own phone. The device on the child automatically answers.
Oh, wow. So you don't need them to do anything.
Right. The parent can immediately hear the surrounding environment to assess the danger, like, are there traffic noises? Water?
That's crucial context.
And they can speak directly to the child to provide calming instructions without the child having to press a single button.
That drastically changes the response time.
It really does.
But there's also a heavy emphasis on low-tech fail-safes in the guide, because cell service drops and batteries die. This involves things like ID tags, medical bracelets, and PEX-CETS cards.
Right, PEX-CETS. That stands for Picture Exchange Communication System. Even if a child is highly verbal at home, travel anxiety can just strip that away. Providing them with a physical card they keep in their pocket, one that says, you know, I am lost, I have autism, please call this number.
It gives them a voice when they can't speak.
Yes, it gives them a concrete way to communicate with a stranger or a police officer when they physically cannot form the words.
That's so smart.
But the crucial part of this low-tech approach is the emergency planning before you leave.
You have to practice using these cards, right?
Exactly. You establish check-in routines when the child is calm in their living room. You build the muscle memory in a safe space so it actually kicks in during a crisis.
Which leads perfectly into how we prevent that crisis from starting in the first place. Since wandering is often triggered by the anxiety of unfamiliar environments, we have to look at how to build familiarity before the luggage even comes out of the closet.
Prep work is everything.
The strategy here revolves around treating the child as a co-pilot rather than just a passenger.
Which is a huge shift. Usually the dynamic is that parents plan the entire itinerary behind closed doors and then present it to the child. Surprise, we're going somewhere completely new.
Right, which we think is a fun reveal. Like, guess what? We're going to Florida.
Exactly. But for a neurodivergent brain, a surprise is just an involuntary injection of unpredictability.
Ouch.
The co-pilot approach flips that. As the parent, you do the initial heavy lifting to curate options that fit the family's needs. You might find three different viable destinations.
But then you bring the child in to make the final choice.
Right. You look at pictures together. You watch walking tours of the specific hotel on YouTube. You let them decide.
And the travel industry is actually adapting to make those choices easier, which is great. Entire destinations are being certified. The guide highlights Mesa, Arizona, as an autism-certified city.
Yes, Mesa has done incredible work.
But what does it actually mean on the ground? Like, are we just talking about a marketing badge, or does it change the physical experience of being in that city?
It fundamentally changes the operational level of the city. To get that certification, it means a significant percentage of the city's public-facing workforce.
Like who, exactly?
From parks department employees to hotel staff to restaurant workers, they've all undergone specialized training.
Oh, wow. So it's everywhere.
Yes. So if a child is having a meltdown in a hotel lobby, an untrained clerk might stare, ask intrusive questions, or just assume the child is misbehaving.
Which just spikes the parent's anxiety to level 10.
Exactly. But a certified clerk is trained to recognize sensory overload, lower the ambient lobby music if possible, offer a quiet room, and communicate with the parents without judgment.
That sounds life-changing.
You're also looking for certifications from groups like Culture City or the Champion Autism Network. They audit venues to ensure they have sensory bags available, designated quiet zones, and clear signage.
So when the child helps pick that hotel because they saw a photo of the exact quiet room they are allowed to use, you've transformed the unknown into something expected.
Precisely. You've removed the fear of the unknown.
The destination is set. But now we hit the physical journey from point A to point B. The gauntlet of transit. Air travel is chaotic, it's loud, it's rigidly structured.
It's the hardest part for a lot of families.
I want to look at the specific logistical hacks recommended here, because they require throwing out almost all standard travel advice. For instance, the first one, do not drive your own car to the airport. Book a cab or a ride service.
Standard advice is all about cost efficiency, right? Drive yourself, park in economy, take the shuttle.
Right, to save money.
But for an autism family, efficiency often equals high stress. If you drive, you have to pack the car, navigate traffic, unpack the luggage at a remote lot.
Wrangle an anxious child onto a crowded, noisy parking shuttle.
Yes, right to the terminal and unload everything all over again. You are stacking unpredictable transitions on top of each other.
So by taking a cab directly to the departures curb,
you eliminate an entire layer of stressful transitions. You conserve the child's cognitive bandwidth for the actual airport.
You are paying a financial premium to lower the psychological toll. I love that phrasing.
It's an investment in the trip's success.
The second hack is about timing. It suggests booking off-peak direct flights.
Mm-hmm.
Now, taking a 6.0 a.m. flight sounds miserable for everyone. How does that actually help?
Well, it's about analyzing the environmental mechanics of an airport. Think about a packed terminal at 1:00 p.m.
Okay. Super crowded, noisy.
Right. The child basically has to sit perfectly still at a crowded gate so they don't bump into people. They are confined before they even get on the plane.
Ah, I see.
An empty terminal at 5:00 a.m. isn't just significantly quieter, though reducing that auditory input is massive. It also provides physical space. The child can walk around, pace, and expend physical energy. They aren't boxed in.
Okay. Here is a hack I want to push back on, though, because it sounds like a massive logistical headache. The guide suggests that when you land, you shouldn't get your rental car right away.
Right.
It says you should take a cab straight to the hotel with the family, let everyone settle in, and then one parent takes a cab back to the airport the next day to deal with the rental counter.
Yeah, I know how that sounds.
Taking a cab twice and losing a chunk of the next morning to go back to the airport seems incredibly annoying and expensive. Is that trade-off actually worth it?
It is about trading a logistical hassle for a psychological one.
Okay.
Think about the state of the family when you land. The child's sensory threshold is likely completely maxed out. They have survived the early morning, the security line, the cabin pressure, the confinement.
They're running on fumes.
Exactly. If you then schlep the entire family to a fluorescent lit rental car center where you have to stand in line for 45 minutes while the child processes a completely different climate and new smells.
Oh, that is the precise moment a severe meltdown occurs.
Bingo. By taking a cab straight to the hotel, you allow the child to immediately decompress in a controlled environment. The parent who goes back the next day does so in peace, fully rested. You are pacing the cognitive load of the trip.
Speaking of pacing the cognitive load, the guide emphasizes preparing for the TSA checkpoints. It recommends using social stories and role-playing at home. Wait, what does a social story actually look like in practice?
Good question.
Like, are we writing a literal book for the kid?
It can take the form of a literal book, actually, or a printed comic strip, or a digital slideshow, depending on what the child responds to.
Okay.
A social story is just a personalized narrative that explicitly illustrates a specific situation so the child knows exactly what to expect.
So for the TSA, what would that say?
The story would break down every step visually. First, we put our bags on the moving belt. Next, we take off our shoes and put them in a bin. Then I will walk through the scanner.
Right.
The machine might beep, and a person in a uniform might ask to look in our bag. That is okay. They are just keeping us safe.
You combine that with role-playing in your living room, having them practice, taking their shoes off, and walking through a doorway.
Yeah.
You remove the novelty of the procedure.
Exactly.
Furthermore, the TSA and many airlines actually have disability programs you can contact in advance.
Yes. TSA Cares is a great one.
So you have a passenger support specialist guiding you through security, bypassing the worst of the crowds.
Which brings us to the final hurdle. You've hacked the transit, you've arrived at your autism-certified destination. How do you maintain equilibrium while you are actually on the vacation?
This requires a totally different mindset. The analogy I'll use here is a battery.
I like this analogy.
An autistic child's sensory battery drains significantly faster than a neurotypical person's, especially in a new environment. Travel drops that battery to 1% almost immediately.
Right.
So you have to constantly plug them into portable chargers to keep the system from shutting down.
What's fascinating here is that the conventional idea of a vacation is to maximize every single minute, right?
See the sights, eat the local cuisine, pack the itinerary.
Exactly. But this guide points out that doing less is the only way the family actually enjoys more. You have to anchor the routine.
And the strongest anchors are sleep and food. The instructions are rigid here. Maintain normal sleep schedules. If your kid goes to bed at 8 p.m. at home, they go to bed at 8:00 p.m. on vacation.
Even if it means missing the cool bioluminescent bay tour at night?
Wow, yeah. That's a tough pill to swallow for some parents.
There is a deep neurological reason for that, though. Sleep is when the brain processes and clears out the sensory data of the day.
Yeah.
A sleep-deprived autistic child lacks the neurological resources to handle even minor changes the next day. The sleep routine is non-negotiable.
And if you were dealing with time zones,
you aggressively manage the circadian rhythm, expose them to bright sunlight first thing in the morning, and serve meals at the new local times to force the internal clock to adjust.
Food predictability is just as critical.
Yeah.
If you have a child who relies on specific safe foods, a vacation is not the time to force culinary exploration.
Definitely not.
The stress of an unfamiliar restaurant with weird lighting and new smells is already draining their battery.
Yeah.
Don't add a strange texture on their plate.
Right. The strategy is to go to the local supermarket as soon as you arrive. Buy the exact brand of crackers they like.
If they eat plain pasta on a Tuesday at home, secure the ingredients so they can eat plain pasta on a Tuesday in paradise.
You are systematically removing the environmental variables that cause anxiety. But you also have to pack for the variables you can't control. You need a dedicated sensory kit in your carry-on or day bag.
Those are the portable chargers I mentioned. We are talking about noise-canceling headphones for when a siren goes off or you walk through a crowded lobby.
Weighted blankets for deep pressure therapy to calm the nervous system. Fidget tools.
And an incredibly practical detail from the guide.
Mm.
Pre-download their favorite shows or videos onto a tablet. Do not rely on airplane Wi-Fi or the hotel connection.
Oh, absolutely not.
If the Wi-Fi drops and they lose access to their primary comfort mechanism, you have an immediate crisis.
It provides a portable safe space that travels with them. And you must structure the itinerary to include built-in quiet time. A day of nonstop stimulation is uniquely exhausting.
Right.
You have to intentionally schedule downtime in low stimulation spaces. That might mean finding a quiet local park, utilizing the sensory room at the certified hotel,
or simply retreating to your room for 2 hours every afternoon where the curtains are drawn and the iPads are on.
Exactly.
So what does this all mean? We've looked at the mechanics of sensory overload, the reality of elopement, the tactical necessity of Pexessi's cards and GPS trackers, and why you might want to skip the rental car counter.
It's a lot of information.
It is. But if we synthesize all this material, the core philosophy is a total reframing of what travel is supposed to be. Planning for spring break with autism isn't about limiting a child's experience out of fear.
No, not at all.
It is about actively engineering an environment where genuine enjoyment becomes neurologically possible. It turns out the best moments usually happen when you slow down, ditch the frantic itinerary, and let your co-pilot lead the way.
It requires a massive paradigm shift away from how we're, you know, culturally conditioned to vacation.
Yeah.
And if we step back from the specific tactical advice for a moment, this raises a really provocative question for you to think about.
Oh, I like where this is going.
If engineering a trip that respects sensory boundaries, prioritizes calm, allows for dedicated afternoon rest, and actively avoids overscheduling makes a vacation dramatically better for a neurodivergent child.
Yeah.
Isn't it highly probable that all of us are secretly exhausted by the chaotic, high-stress way society demands we vacation?
Oh, wow.
What if the autism-friendly model prioritizing rest over constant stimulation isn't just an accommodation, but actually just a fundamentally better, more restorative way for humans to travel?
That entirely changes the lens on why we travel in the first place. I mean, we rush to the airport, stress over reservations, sprint from museum to museum, and come home needing a vacation from our vacation.
Exactly. We do it to ourselves.
Looking at travel through this low-stimulation, co-pilot approach brings us back to that opening premise. The anticipation of a trip doesn't have to be a minefield. with the right strategies to pace the cognitive load and the permission to just do a little bit less.
It can actually just be a break.
For the whole family.